Lecture 8, From Anarchy to Tyranny in Athens.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back. As I talked about in the last lecture, the people of Athens were still far from having any common political outlook, and they were also dissatisfied, unhappy with what Solon had done. Why did they feel this way, and were they justified to do so? Those were two questions with which I ended the previous lecture. We'll spend the first part of this lecture considering these questions, and by extension, should we call Solon's legislation successful? Then in the second half of the lecture, we'll consider the aftermath of his legislation, because despite what he did, Athens was headed for a tyranny. Now, Solon's constitution was utopian because he assigned people into these four property groups based on where he thought their places should be in society. There was no poll, there was no questionnaire. People were put where he thought they should go. And a sign of the dissatisfaction that the people had with this is perhaps the resistance to his wanting the farmers to switch to olive cultivation on a much larger scale. Generally speaking, though, the poor thought he hadn't gone far enough because he didn't redistribute the land. The hoplites, those would be the members of the Zygete group, would also have been dissatisfied because he'd opened up to them only the relatively minor political office of the Thesmothetae, not the archonships. Remember, only the top two groups were eligible for those. And so the hoplites were still denied a share in real power, in other words, the archonship. The aristocrats thought Solon had gone too far with things like the cancellation of the debts, the Seisachtheia, the abolition of birth for wealth as the prerequisite for political office, and the holding of regular assemblies, attended by all citizens, and which also monitored the activities of the archons. So perhaps it's not a surprise then that he did upset all sides of society, both sides, rich and poor, noble and non-noble. But as I said before, Solon wasn't interested in winning popularity and making friends. He chose to suffer the wrath of both sides because he wanted to act only in the city's best interests. But at the same time, he lets fly at the people for the way they criticized him. He tells us this in his poetry when he writes, "Now they're angry with me. Everyone looks at me with suspicion, as if I'm their enemy. It shouldn't be like this. What I said, I did with the gods' help." And in another fragment of the poetry, he writes, "What the people now have, their eyes would never have seen, even in their dreams. Those whose lives are more powerful and more lucky should praise me and make me their friend." I really like the part about how the people couldn't even imagine what they now had in their dreams. Could this be the origin of the expression, "in your dreams"? As with Dracon's laws, Solon's were inscribed on kerbes and axones, you know, those wooden blocks with the four sides with writing on each side, and they were set up on poles in the portico of the office of the Basileus Archon in the Agora. Now, we're told that this is where the nine archons took their oath when coming into office. And they also promised to dedicate a gold statue at Delphi if they transgressed any of Solon's laws. Now, this was a practice that continued into the 320s BC, because the Athenian constitution says that the archons were still doing this in its own time, in the 320s BC. The Athenian constitution also tells us that Solon made his laws complicated and ambiguous in their wording, so that the Athenians were often in dispute with them. Now, we have to take the Athenian constitution's word at this, because we don't actually have anything that we can say, oh, this is one of Solon's original laws. Wow, look at how opaque it's worded. We don't have any like that. So we have to rely on these later sources that tell us this sort of information. And if they're right, that raises an interesting question. Why would Solon make his laws deliberately hard to understand? Did he slip up? Did he overestimate the intelligence of the people? Well, no, he didn't overestimate their intelligence. Everything that Solon did was for a reason. And making his laws hard to understand was deliberate. And it was a good thing, too, because it meant that the people would have to learn to interpret them rather than blindly follow black and white guidelines. However, it seems the people were constantly pestering Solon about this law or that law. They were bellyaching about them to him. They were wanting him to tell them what his laws meant and, therefore, what they needed to do. So he decided that his presence in Athens was having the opposite effect to what he wanted, which was, remember, to make the people think. And with this in mind, he left Athens and went to Egypt. The Athenian constitution says that he went there to engage in trade and to see the sights, so he went on holidays. He vowed not to return to Athens for 10 years. And so we end our discussion of what Solon did with him sailing down the Nile and off into the sunset. We don't end our consideration of Solon at this point, however, because I want to turn to the last question. If the people were dissatisfied with him, as they seem to have been, and he recognizes that they were, then should we be able to ask the question, how successful was he? Is this a legitimate question to ask of someone who had introduced all of this political, social, economic, and judicial legislation? So it's an odd question, but it's an important one. And it's part of the fun that history is all about. It would be boring if we didn't ask questions. There's no doubt that Solon's legislation had far-reaching consequences as far as those political, economic, and judicial areas went. And we can recognize his importance in history. But was he successful? Usually, the immediate answer is yes, because people think of what he did. After all, this is the father of democracy we're talking about, isn't it? So how could he have done anything wrong? But technically, the correct answer ought to be no. Solon wasn't successful. Because after he left Athens, after he went to Egypt, the grievances of both sides, that's noble and non-noble, soon exploded again. And civil strife broke out yet one more time. It wouldn't be long before we have a couple of periods of anarchy, and then a tyranny in Athens that lasted for almost 40 years, that takes us almost to the end of the 6th century, and this we'll come on to in a moment. Remember that Solon had been made extraordinary archon by the Eupatridae to end the civil war. Well, he didn't end the civil war, because after he left Athens, civil strife again broke out, and eventually we have warfare again. So technically then, he was unsuccessful. We can even argue that Solon steered Athens down the path to tyranny, because thanks to him, there was even more of a struggle now for the archonship. Now previously, only the Eupatridae had held this office, as we know. But now aristocrats, who hadn't been part of the Eupatrid rulers, remember they weren't the super aristocrats, so they didn't have political office, but now they were wealthy enough to be in those top two groups. Now these guys wanted a crack at power. And there were probably some traders who were rich enough to be placed in those top two groups as well. They also wanted to have a crack at the archonship. But the Eupatridae was resisting them. So we can come up with a negative assessment of Solon if we want to. But then again, do his successes outweigh these failures? Think about this. How should we measure success? And therefore, how should we evaluate Solon? I often set this sort of question in exams to my students because it makes them do something they're not used to, and that's think. They don't like that. But when they do write things down, usually I find there's a 50-50 split. Those who think that his successes do outweigh his failures, and those who think they do not. I'm going to leave it to you to decide. And once again, I would welcome emails from you with what you think. And I mean that. I love getting emails. And, you know, sometimes I even answer them. Now I want to move to the second part of my lecture, and that is the aftermath of Solon's departure and the rise to power of Pisistratus the tyrant. So what we're going to do now in the rest of this lecture is get us down to the year 545 BC. So we're going to cover about 50 years or so. Now, not long after Solon left Athens for Egypt to go on his Nile cruise, the old conflicts, which he'd been appointed to end, reared their heads again. It seems that they were centered on control of that office of eponymous archon. And that shows us again that of the three archons, Basileus, Polymarchus, and Eponymus, that last one was the most important. The Athenian constitution tells us that for about 4 years after Solon left Athens, there was a peace of sorts in Attica. His constitution was settling down a bit. But then we're told that there were no archon elections in 590 or in 586, and there weren't any archon elections because of civil strife. Now, no elections point to anarchia or anarchy. So the Eupatridae presumably were no longer accepting Solon's opening up of the archonship to those who were not Eupatrid, to those who were not born of the noble father that made them the upper echelon of the aristocrats. It didn't matter how wealthy they were, there was resistance to these people. Worse was to follow. The archon for 582.1, a chap called Demasias, stayed in office beyond his legal year for another 14 months, until finally he was deposed by force. In other words, he tried to remain eponymous archon for 2 years and 2 months before he was finally kicked out. It's unknown whether Demasias was attempting a tyranny, or whether he was a member of a Eupatrid family that was resisting all others, including these newcomers, and clinging onto that office and not wanting to give it up because of the way the constitution had changed. We don't know. But what we can say is that as the 590s and 580s wore on, conditions in Attica can't have been that different from the time before Solon. Anarchia, a possible attempted tyranny. Everything that Solon had been asked to fix was happening again. And we have to factor these sorts of things into any assessment of Solon's success. We just have to. And so we start to get a scenario for the rise of three factions in Attica that contend for political power. And we see in these three factions the emergence on the political scene of Pisistratus, the champion of the poor. And it's Pisistratus who would establish a tyranny that lasted for most of the second half of the 6th century. Now, our sources indicate that at this time, there was faction strife involving several noble families, and that these families were broadly divided into three geographical / political groups. And we'll talk about these three groupings now. One group was called the Men of the Plain. This was the area closest to Athens. And these Men of the Plain group were led by a certain man called Lycurgus. The second group was called the Men of the Coast. This was the area that extended around Athens and southwards down to Cape Sunion on the Attic promontory, what is today called the Apolline Coast. This group was led by a man called Megacles. And finally, we have our third group, the men beyond the hills, Diakria in the Greek. And beyond the hills refers to the area that was east of Athens, beyond Mount Hymettus, this mountain that towers over Athens. And this group was led by a nobleman called Pisistratus. He came from Brauron in eastern Attica, and he had won renown in a recent war with Megara, which was on Attica's western border. So, like the tyrants in other states that we've talked about, Pisistratus used his reputation from this warfare to support his bid for power. So he was already a household name by the time that he tried to establish a tyranny. Now, these three groups, the men of the plain, the men of the coast, the men from beyond the hills, these three groups were not just geographical ones depending on where their leaders' power bases lay, but there was a political nature to them as well. And this political nature arose from their geographical areas. So the men of the plain represented the oldest aristocratic families. They were eager for oligarchy, and they were keen to see the undiminished power of the Eupatridae return. So these were the hardcore oligarchs. The men of the coast were also aristocratic, but because of their location, the majority probably engaged in trade and fishing. They seem to have favoured a middle or moderate type of constitution, and that would have been in keeping with the mass of them being hoplites. Finally, the men beyond the hills, and that's a reference, as I said before, to Mount Hymettus. This group favoured a constitution in which the people as a whole, noble and non-noble, had a say in political affairs. In that part of Attica, in eastern Attica, beyond Mount Hymettus, most of the people would have been ordinary farmers. But the Athenian constitution tells us that this group also included a motley assortment of other people. And these included men who had become poor because of the Seisachtheia, and those who were not of pure Athenian descent. Now the first type, those made poor because of the Seisachtheia, that refers to the measure that Solon introduced that cancelled all debts. The Seisachtheia was the shaking off of burdens. It's interesting because it shows us that that measure, the Seisachtheia, evidently hurt many aristocrats. When their debts were not repaid, some of them obviously fell down mightily and ended up several rungs down the social ladder. So it hurt them economically, and they attached themselves to Pisistratus' group. The second type, the non-pure Athenian citizens, shows us that some non-citizens evidently aspired to the citizenship, but they would never get it under the existing regime. So Pisistratus then was their only hope. Now, although Pisistratus was a nobleman, as I said, he seems to have set himself up as champion of the poor. This is just like the tyrants did in other areas. Think of Argos, Sicyon, Corinth, as we talked about. We can therefore say that Pisistratus headed a radical group that wanted a new form of rule. And the Athenian constitution even calls him a democrat. Pisistratus also wanted to end the faction fighting between the nobles, which was the cause of all of Athens's problems. And he also wanted, of course, to establish himself as tyrant. Now, whether he was a conscious reformer who did champion the rights of the poor, or whether he was exploiting the civil unrest for his own political advancement, so they say he did want to establish a tyranny, and he did, well, we're not sure about these, but we'll be discussing these aspects in our lectures on the Pisistratid tyranny that come up in the next one and the one after that. Now, It took Pisistratus 3 attempts to seize power and hold on to it. His first attempt was in about 560 BC, so we're 34 years or so after Solon. We're told the story that he beat himself up and appeared in the Agora one day covered in bruises. He claimed that he'd been attacked by his opponents and he asked for a bodyguard. Now, apparently Solon spoke against this. He evidently saw right through Pisistratus' ruse, but it's hard to accept this as historical. It's hard to accept that Solon was in Athens at the time and counseled the people against giving Pisistratus a bodyguard. Solon was supposed to have left Athens for 10 years, remember, in 594. And even if he did return to Athens after his Egypt trip, that would be in the late 580s. So by 560, he'd be very old. It's not impossible, but it's a bit of a stretch of the imagination. But the more of a reason why I question it is because I would expect the Athenian constitution to say something about it, to have some reference to Solon being against Pisistratus, when the Athenian constitution talks about Solon being against tyranny. In other words, when we get to that section of the Athenian constitution that quotes Solon's poetry and says that he could have been tyrant but chose not to, that's where I would expect the Athenian constitution to have a line something like, we know that Solon hated tyranny because he told the people later not to give Pisistratus a bodyguard, but they didn't listen to him. To me, and I tell my students this all the time, to me, what the sources don't say is often as important as what they do say. Anyway, the people bought Pisistratus' story. That a hero from the war against Megara was attacked by opponents was unthinkable. And so Pisistratus was immediately voted an armed bodyguard. We know it was armed because it was called the Club Bearers. And with this bodyguard, he seized the Acropolis, the citadel of Athens, and proclaimed himself tyrant. The story continues about Solon that when Pisistratus proclaimed himself tyrant, Solon went to get his armor, so that would be hoplite armor, and he set his armor up in front of his house, and apparently he said to the people, "I've done all I can to help my country." In other words, he was saying, "Told you so. I told you not to give him a bodyguard, but did you listen to me? Oh, no." Well, it's a nice story, but as I say, it may not be historical. Well, Pisistratus' attempt at tyranny failed, though. The families of the two other groups, the men of the plain led by Lycurgus, the men of the coast led by Megacles, united and kicked him out of Athens. So his first tyranny then probably lasted only a few weeks, couldn't have lasted more than a couple of months. Pisistratus, though, was not a man to give up easily. He tried a second time in probably 556, so about four and a half years later. And it's surprising how he comes back to Athens, because his former enemy, Megacles, brought him back. It looks as though Megacles, remember he's the leader of the men of the coast, was losing out in the struggles with Lycurgus. In other words, he wasn't getting elected archon. So Megacles must have thought that by bringing Pisistratus back, he would help support his bid for the archonship. But he wasn't just bringing Pisistratus back as another ruler, as a possible tyrant of Athens to help Megacles. He wanted to bring him back as his son-in-law. He offered Pisistratus the hand of his daughter in marriage. And that, of course, would bind Pisistratus and Megacles closer together. Son-in-law, father-in-law. This is Megacles, may even have thought that he could use Pisistratus as his puppet ruler to control Athens. And there's no question then that if this was the case, then Megacles' ascendancy would soar over that of Lycurgus. Remember, Megacles was losing out in the archon elections. That means Lycurgus was winning. Lycurgus and his faction, that is. The big question was how to bring Pisistratus back. Lycurgus isn't going to let this happen without a fight, and the people also might not be taken in so easily this time. I mean, beating up Pisistratus wasn't going to work this time. The people had been fooled before. They weren't going to be fooled again. So Megacles came up with the idea of exploiting religion. In other words, trickery. And the story that I'm going to tell you now is a really nice example of the political exploitation of religion. There was a very tall lady named Phaia who came from the town of Paeania. This was a town on the other side of Mount Hymettus. Herodotus, one of our ancient sources, and we'll talk more about Herodotus in a few lectures' time, Herodotus gives us her height, and it works out at about 5'10". Now, she was tall, and the fact that the sources say that she was tall shows us that women in this period were not all that tall. It's just like when someone lives to a grand old age, that's unusual, and so our sources comment on it. Therefore, life expectancy wasn't as long as it is today. People then who are very tall deserve comment because they're unusual. So this was a tall lady then. Anyway, Phaia was dressed up as the goddess Athena, the patron deity of Athens. She and Pisistratus rode inside a chariot into the city, and heralds ran in front of them proclaiming that the goddess herself was bringing back her chosen ruler. Well, word of this spread like wildfire. Lycurgus could hardly compete with the patron deity of Athens bringing back the person she wanted to rule her city. And the people accepted this too. They accepted what was happening without question. And so Pisistratus became tyrant for a second time. Now, Herodotus refers to the fire episode as a simple-minded trick. But we shouldn't come down so hard on the people for being naive. I mean, today we might question a god driving a Republican or a Democratic candidate through the streets of Washington, D.C. But back then, back in the archaic period, we're still in an age where the Greeks have not yet started to question the role of gods in human affairs. We haven't yet moved to the rational period. The Greeks still believe that the gods take a first-hand role in human affairs. They still believe that the gods will come down to earth or pop up from down there and mingle with humans. So although Herodotus calls this trick simple-minded, it's actually not when we consider what the people were willing to accept. They accepted that the gods took on human form and acted as and when they saw fit. So it's not unusual then if Athena did interfere in the city's affairs in this way. Pisistratus and Megacles knew this, and so they merely exploited religious beliefs. We'll see this political exploitation of religion a lot of times in our course, and not just with Athens. If Megacles thought he could dominate his new son-in-law, he was mistaken. Pisistratus refused to consummate the marriage with his new wife, probably because he had sons from a previous marriage. He didn't want his other sons to be passed over by any children from his marriage to Megacles' daughter, so he just didn't have sex with her. But he obviously miscalculated how secure he was in his power, because Megacles found out what he was doing, or rather wasn't doing, and so he forced Pisistratus into exile again. Well, Pisistratus would now be absent from Athens for 10 years. He will eventually end up living in Thrace, close to very rich gold and silver mines in the area of Pangaea. And he's able to use these natural resources to build up a huge financial reserve. And he uses this newfound wealth to hire mercenaries. And that's why 10 years later in 545, he invades Attica at the head of a personal army. He's intent this time on seizing power and holding onto it for good. Pisistratus landed at Marathon in eastern Attica. And at Pallene, he defeated an army that the nobles in Athens had sent out to try to stop him reaching the city. Pisistratus was now determined that he wasn't going to be kicked out of Athens again. And to this end, he disarmed the citizens to make sure there wouldn't be an uprising against him. He did this with a very neat trick. He called all the people together in the agora to attend like a public information forum. And he asked them to come there under arms, to bring their weaponry. When they gathered in the agora, he spoke quietly to them, deliberately quietly, so they couldn't hear him. Whisper, 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 whisper. And when they shouted up, "Oi, speak up!" he said, "This is no good. Let's all move to the Acropolis. We'll go to the entranceway where you'll be able to hear me better." Well, the people agreed to this. And as they went to the Acropolis, they put their arms down, their weaponry down in the process. Well, Pisistratus addressed the crowd again from the entranceway to the Acropolis. And as he spoke to them, his supporters were busy gathering up the weapons and locking them away. Now, just to be on the safe side, that is to make sure that the people didn't rise up to attack him, Pisistratus went everywhere with his own mercenary bodyguard. As for his principal opponents, those are the noble families. Many of these, several hundred in fact, fled into exile. Those families that didn't flee into exile, he took their sons as hostage, and he deposited them on the island of Naxos, where his friend and ally Lygdamis was tyrant. And so Athens falls under a tyranny, the one thing that the Eupatridae had worked to prevent since the time of Dracon, almost a century earlier. Pisistratus would remain tyrant now until his death in 528 BC, when his two sons take over from him. Now, the Athenian constitution calls Pisistratus's rule the Age of Chronos, a golden age in Athens's history. We're going to find out why in our next lecture. Thank you very much.